Okay, so this is going to be the second lecture on the upper and lower bounds for some Gaussian matrices. And then we'll see this development of the epsilon net method that we just spoke about. And a completely new tool, a finer tool than the epsilon net method, is a multi-scale epsilon net method. And there we will learn some basic tools of random processes in order to reveal the theory. It's called Douglas controllers. That's this lecture. And so our goal is, in view of the restricted isometry condition, to prove that restricted isometry condition, we need to verify upper and lower bounds on random matrices. Namely, we prove an upper bound. Upper bound meaning that for a sub-Gaussian random matrix, all matrices, so big N is bigger than big. For a tall sub-Gaussian random matrix, its largest singular value, which is the norm of the matrix of the Euclidean norm, which is a maximum of the norm of AX over the sphere, is bounded by the square root of the big of the sum of the square roots of the dimensions after a constant. And then matched the asymptotic bound in the asymptotic theory of random matrices that predicts the C to be constant 1. But we cannot do that. Yeah. Not at least in with this group. So this holds with exponential large probability. That's a nice result. But now we want to bound, to have to prove a lower bound in that matrix for lambda minimum instead of lambda maximum. Smallest singular value, which is the minimum of the norm of AX over the whole sphere. And if we, as soon as we get upper and lower bounds, and hopefully they are not far apart, then we will control the norm of AX over the whole sphere, both upper and lower. Say that the norm of AX will be roughly the same for all vectors X. And that will mean that our matrix is an almost isometry. And that will verify the restricted isometry condition. And this will lead to approximate to the reconstruction, sparse reconstruction by incandescent and Thomas. So the only thing we need to do now is to prove the lowest singular value for random matrices. Well, we'll actually try to do both, to kill both at once, to prove both upper and lower at once, to control the norm of AX tightly around some value with high probability. That will mean that both upper and lower will be satisfied. Okay. So this will be done by the epsilon net method, already familiar. So in order to tightly control the norm of AX above and below for all vectors, remember that the A is a random matrix and X is an arbitrary vector. In order to do this, as usual, as before, we will discretize the sphere. So we will replace the sphere by a small epsilon net, which will immediately lower the complexity of the problem. We will no longer need to prove something for all vectors in the sphere, which is infinite number of vectors, but just for finite number of vectors. We actually know how many vectors there are. So we'll discretize the sphere, that's approximation argument, based on compactness covering argument. Now, for every point in the epsilon net, we will prove a concentration bound. So we will control the norm of AX for every fixed X. That will be a random variable. The norm of AX will be a random variable for a given vector X. But now the situation is better now because we'll have just one random variable to verify for each fixed X. We'll have a random variable. And we will prove that it is concentrated near one value. What will the value be? Well, the mean, of course, is the nicest bound around which all the random variables should be concentrated. Right? So we'll prove that the random variable AX is concentrated near its mean, its expectation M, with high probability. And what is the basic probabilistic intuition, basic probabilistic statement that proves such things is the limit theorem. Probability theory, such as both large number, central limit theorem, and so forth. So we will do this, hopefully with high probability, and then we take the union bound to pass from one vector on the net to all vectors in the net. So we'll do the union bound. The high probability will be high enough to cover all of them. So we'll prove that AX is close to M for all vectors in the net. Pass from one vector to the whole net, and then from the whole net to the whole sphere by approximation. Is that the schemes? Discretized sphere, true for every point in the discretized net, and then extend. Okay. Alright, so this will be a new version of the epsilon net method. Very classical. So, alright, so we'll probably, so we are already done with the discretization argument. We know that the epsilon net can be found with cardinality exponential in the dimension. We now want to prove concentration. So we want to prove some sort of central limit theorem that will tell us that for every vector, for every fixed vector x, the norm of ax will be nicely concentrated around it. Okay. So here's a random variable, the norm of ax. What is this random variable? How is it? What's the distribution of that random variable? That's the first thing to understand. In order to apply central limit theorems or other limit theorems, probably. Alright, so how do we get norm of Ax? This is our matrix A. We look at the rows Ak of that matrix. And the norm of Ax squared is going to be the sum of the inner products Ak against X squared. Right? Imagine what you're doing when you're multiplying the matrix A by a vector X. You just do this, just sum up the inner product squared, that's what you are. Okay, so this is a random variable. What is particularly nice about this random variable is that it is a sum of independent random variables. So we are in a good shape playing limit theory to probability. We have enough independence. It's a classical object, sum of independent random variables. Now let's understand how the random variables are distributed individually. And this is a little exercise to check that since A is a sub-Gaussian random variable, since A is a sub-Gaussian matrix, then each AK is trivially, all the entries are sub-Gaussian. So what is the inner product of AKX? It's a linear combination, right? It's a sum of coordinates of this times coordinates of this. So it's a weighted sum of the sub-Gaussian random variables. If it was a Gaussian, Gaussian matrix, this will be exactly a Gaussian random variable. This linear combination of Gaussians is Gaussian. Same is true for sub-Gaussian checklist. So this is still true. So each of the AKX is a sub-Gaussian random variable. But now we have a little bit of a problem here because we do not sum the norms of AK, because we do not sum these inner products by themselves. So they're not sub-Gaussians that we sum. We sum their squares. And the sum of the squares are called sub-exponential. The squares of sub-Gaussian random variables are called sub-exponential random variables. For this very simple reason, because if you take the square and look at the tail bound, when you complete the square here, it would be, so instead of the ct squared for sub-Gaussian, you have just minus ct, a little bit milder tail. The sub-exponential random variable, this is how our random variables are distributed, because they're the squares of sub-Gaussian. Still nice, very exponential decay. So what we have is sums of exponential random variables, independent, identically distributed sub-exponential random variables. So sum of independent random variables is where the central limit theorem should be upheld. With the only important difference between this and this classical central limit theory is that we have to be non-asymptotic here. We have to apply a version of the central limit theorem that is non-asymptotic, that is valid for every fixed n. That should not tell that something converges to the normal distribution in the limit, but something that's good at every collection of random variables. This area in probability theory is called theories of large deviations, and there are many concentration of large deviation equalities available. I'll put up one of these. It's a version of Bernstein inequality. And you can look at it as a non-asymptotic version of central limit theorem, because it's valid for every given collection of random variables and not their limit. So if you have independent sub-exponential mean zero random variables, and look at their normalized sum, I do not subtract expectation because this is zero, they are, I should have put variance one. So with variance one, this is the right normalization. And central limit theorem will tell you that, the classical central limit theorem, will tell you that this normalized sum will converge to the Gaussian. Okay? So we have a Gaussian tail. That's, in this view, it's natural to have Bernstein's inequality. It has, it says that the these random variables, the sums, will indeed be like Gaussians, or even better. We'll have nicer, maybe nicer tables. The important thing is that it holds for every fixed n. Well, the again, the important difference here with the central limit theorem is that we cannot hope to have this. To have this inequality, sub-Gaussian inequality, in the whole range of t, because imagine that z itself is a sub-exponential, but it may not be sub-Gaussian random variable, right? So eventually, the tail of z is not enough. It may be heavy enough for the Gaussian tail. So this statement is true for some range of t initially, where the central limit theorem. Think of central limit theorem as being a melting pot in which your random variables are convolved. And they are convolved in certain range, and you have these bubbles that are going around, and they are stepping. So these bubbles make this nice Gaussian tail, normal distribution. But away from this range, the central limit theorem is not cooked enough. There is still few convolutions of the random variables. So away from this, in this range, central limit theorem does not hold. For t bigger than the square root of n, but inside some region it holds. So this is an important thing when you look at non-asymptotic version of central limit theorem. In the limit, it would be okay everywhere. Before the limit, it's only true in some range. Okay, so this is Bernstein's inequality, and actually, if you take sub Gaussian here, it will work for all t. As I said, the normalized sum of sub Gaussian is sub Gaussian. For sub-exponential, it's not true, but it's true in some range. All right. So it says us, the Bernstein inequality says that the central limit theorem, the range of applicability of central limit theorem propagates as you increase the number of variables. Starting from the origin, this bell-shaped curve gets propagated. Okay. All right, so this concentration bound. And we've just applied directly to our sum. To our norm of AX, which we want to control, as a sum of some exponential random variables, we only have to compute the norm of the variance, or the mean of the variance. So the mean of each random variable, because the entries have variance 1, it's easy to check that the mean is actually 1. Okay, so this is the mean. So we subtract that mean, the mean is 1, so we subtract this mean from each of the random variables in order to make them centered, mean zero. Okay. So now this is centered. So they are centered sub-Gaussian random variables, independent. Sum them up. Central limit theorem applies. And with this normalization, y divided by the square root of n, the right normalization Bernstein inequality, we get this exponential, this sub-Gaussian theorem. Just a direct application of Bernstein inequality. I put it up. And just convenient to normalize. You remember our normalized version of our matrix is 1 divided by square root of n of the original matrix, just to make the columns norm 1. So we normalize by dividing by square root of n. This is our normalized version of that. It's nice here because now we see that not only we see the exponential, the sub-Gaussian tail, but we have an exponential n here, e to the minus n, which will be responsible for killing the union bound. It's very nice. And we can drop the square here because the absolute value of I minus 1 is smaller than its square root for positive. Okay, so we have this concentration bound which controls the norm of AX near 1 for every fixed vector X. That's what we need. Now we need to unfix X because remember what we are doing. We want to control this norm of AX for all vectors on the sphere, not for one vector. How do we unfix X? We do the discretization of the sphere. pick an epsilon net of the sphere, exponential cardinality, and unfix f. Make it run through the whole union, through the whole epsilon net by the union bound. So that the probability that the norm of AX deviates badly from one for some x in the net is bounded by the cardinality of the epsilon net, that's how many choices for x you have, times the individual one. Classically, union bound. And of course, we want to make this small, at least smaller than one. That's our probability. We want to make this bound small, and actually, we can make it smaller than epsilon to the power n by choosing s correctly. So s is our free parameter, it's our handle that we can pull down so that the exponential term kills the cardinality of the epsilon n, which is also exponential. And if you compute what s must be in order that this is smaller than epsilon to the n, it will be that, square root of y times log.
And the condition s is less than 1 when you renormalize the form?
Yes, and this, with the assumption that s is smaller than 1. So this must be smaller than 1. Okay, and then, so, all right, so we proved this inequality, this concentration inequality now for all vectors on the epsilon net simultaneously. Controlled that. Now we extend it from epsilon net to the whole sphere. That's our final step. By approximation, there we use that this is actually an epsilon net and not an arbitrary set. The epsilon net is such that every point on the sphere can be epsilon approximated by a point in an epsilon net. So if you control, if your norm of AX, norm of the action of the matrix, is very close to some value which is 1 here on the epsilon net, then if you step away from epsilon by a little bit, the norm of AX should not deviate by much because we have an upper bound. So this is how it's done. The norm of AX minus the norm of AY, where X is arbitrary vector and Y is in the net, is by the triangle inequality smaller than the norm of A of X minus Y, which is, this is smaller than epsilon. And from the previous lecture, we know the norm, we know an upper bound of that metric, which is roughly 1 plus square root of the aspect ratio. It's a normalized version. See that? Okay. So X is our arbitrary vector. Y is a vector that we approximated with in epsilon net. X and Y are very close to each other, epsilon close to each other. So that the norm of the difference is epsilon. And the norm of the random metrics we just computed in the previous lecture. It's an order of a constant. Think of a constant. Don't even need this one. Which total is smaller than epsilon?
Can I ask one of those?
Yes.
Epsilon times 1 plus something.
Oh, right. It should be wiggled. Yeah. Two epsilons. I assume that y, the metric is total, so the aspect ratio is smaller than 1. It should be twiggle. Okay. So in conclusion, we made a tight control of the norm of AX over the whole sphere. How tight it is? How tight is it? It's so at least at most S from this bound and the epsilon net. And then there is epsilon that accounts for approximation. It's S plus epsilon. And remember what epsilon was, S was, it's square root of Y log 1 over epsilon, and then plus epsilon. And if epsilon is smaller than y, then the first term will dominate. And we've proved this theorem. So this is a conclusion. That if you have a sub-Gaussian random matrix, y, then for every epsilon smaller than the aspect ratio with very high probability, we get upper and lower bounds. If you think of an epsilon as being a constant, let's say y is an aspect ratio which is a constant, just for time being, like 1/2. Epsilon is also a constant, it will be 1 minus c squared root of y, and then c squared root of 1, upper and lower. That almost matches asymptotic theory, which predicts everything without the log 1 epsilon factor. This is the parasitic factor. So this is not yet quite final, because the synthetic theory predicts 1 plus or minus y on both sides. And theorem, this theorem yields only y times log of 1 over 1. We'll fix this later by a different method. But even in this imperfect form, it already implies our conclusion for sparse recovery. It already implies that some Gaussian matrices are restricted asymmetries. You just apply this conclusion for every given minor, every submatrix. Probability for every minor will be very large, exponential, enough to handle the union bound over exponential of any minors. And this will prove your restricted asymmetry for sub-Gaussian random matrices. This is the conclusion. So with exponentially high probability, a sub-Gaussian matrix is a restricted asymmetry, provided that the number of measurements, which is the smallest dimension n, is linear in the sparsity and logarithmic in the d, in the dimension of n. And once you have the restricted asymmetry condition, then Candescent-Tower restricted asymmetry theorem tells you that you can reconstruct any n sparse vector from its measurements using the convex program, this convex program. So this is how many measurements you need to take in order to reconstruct a sparse vector from arbitrary with high probability using arbitrary sub-Gaussian measurement matrices. It can be Bernoulli, it can be Gaussian, it can be some bounded number variables. Any questions on this? And I think Jared will talk more about Gaussian case, right? So for the Gaussian random variables, you will have much more precise information on the constant implicit here. So the constant can be actually computed. Okay. So let's go back to our theorem for sub-Gaussian random matrices, upper and lower bounds. There is this logarithm with this band. Logarithmic factor that should not be there. We want the theorem without any logarithmic factor. The theorem that will predict that will compute the upper and lower singular values for sub-Gaussian random matrices of the same sort as asymptotic theory. Match the limit. We're going to remove the log factor. And the new tool that we learned here is maybe more important than the result itself. And the new tool will be random. Somebody disagreed. The new tool will be random processes. So we will replace epsilon net method with a multi-scale epsilon net method. If you go back and think of the epsilon net method, we just fixed one epsilon and never changed it. So now what we're going to do is we're going to progressively refine the epsilon net and make epsilon go smaller and smaller and smaller in order that it captures the sphere, the geometry of the sphere better and better and better, and in conclusion it will give better estimates for random measures. So the inequality that we'll learn is Dudley's inequality, a basic tool in modern probability theory. So the first thing is to connect random matrices to random processes in probability theory. Here's our desired bound. Note that we will not have logarithmic factor anymore. Again, it simply says that the norm of AX is concentrated tightly near its mean 1, because it's almost like both sides are like 1 plus or minus some small factor. So here's what it means. Right? The maximum of the norm of AX squared minus 1 is of order square root of 1. That's our desired bound. Again, the problem is that we have the full sphere without taking the maximum. This will hold with high probability just from Bernstein inequality, central inequality. The problem is to cover the whole sphere, handle the whole sphere. So for each individual x, this random variable is nice. It's a random variable. We know everything about it, central limit theorem, holds, Bernstein inequality, all the information. But we have a collection of them. Each random variable depends also on x, on the vector from the sphere. So we have to deal with the collection of random variables indexed by the sphere. This is called the random process. Whenever you have a collection of random variables instead of one random variable, you have a random process. Usually random process is indexed by time or Brownian motion. Time is the index. But here the index is a sphere. It doesn't change things very much. So our goal is to bound the random process above. If you bound it above, this by the form of the random process will imply both lower and upper bounds in the random matrices. How can you bound random processes? That's question number one. It's also question number one in certain field of probability theory. So bounds and random processes. And we will now step back from this concrete situation about the matrices and spheres and so on. And we will just look at random processes in general. So we look at the random at the center, mean zero, random process on the metric space T. In our particular situation, T is a sphere, but usually it's time with transition motion. Our goal is to bound the maximum of the random process, supremal random process, over the time. And think of like what you're measuring here is how far can your particle get, the Brownian motion particle can get over a certain interval of time. What is the farthest point that you can get? We want to measure this. Compute the maximum in terms of the geometry of T. We want to get away from probability theory, just to use the geometry of T. Like the length of for example, the time that left from the origin. So, all right, so this is, we have to put some assumptions on the speed of that process. Our Brownian motion is not fast enough. So we have to control the speed of the process, and the speed is measured with the increments. So the increments of the random process, we divide by the time, so this is the increment, divided by the time elapsed from T to S, we want to say this is not big. This is controllable uniformly. This is our speed, the rate of the process. And the specific form of this assumption is that this is a random variable, right? For every given T and S, it's a random variable, and we assume that it's a Gaussian for every T and S. That will imply it has expectation bounded by a constant. So this is a form of the assumption that tells you that your random process is not fast enough, too fast. So such processes are called sub-Gaussian random processes, and the examples are Gaussian processes, and one instance of Gaussian processes, Brownian motion. How do you control this? How do you bound that? We want to bound the maximum of the process in terms of the geometry. And the geometry of the random of the index set T of the metric space will be captured by what we already know. This is the quantitative notion of compactness. When we say the set is compact, we already infer something about geometry. So now we say something quantitative about it, we control the covering numbers. So assume that the covering number, the number of epsilon balls needed to cover the index set, is small. So assume that we can cover T by say 10 balls. What will be the size of this our process? How far it can get? Okay, so this is the setting clear? Is that good? So this is a basic setting in random process theory. And the basic theorem about random processes, the speed, the size of random processes is Dudley's inequality. It bounds the average size of the random process, which is what we need, by its covering numbers. Integral of the square root of the covering numbers. What is important here is that all of the covering numbers for all the scales contribute to the right-hand side. This is where it is a multi-scale version of the epsilon net method. Not only we cover T by an epsilon net, by a union of the epsilon ball, but we try to cover T with all sizes of epsilon ball for all epsilons between 0 and infinity. Actually, infinity, you do not need to do infinity there because the space is compact, it's bound, and so on. So the left hand side here is probabilistic, it's about random processes. The right hand side is geometric, it's about coverings. This is where the theorem is so nice. right hand side is it's a bound probabilistic quantity in terms of geometric. It's very useful. So it's a multi-scale epsilon net method. Infinity is not important because it can be replaced by the diameter, of course. Of course, you can cover everything, the whole space with just one ball big enough, bigger than the diameter of T. And so the bad thing does not happen at infinity. The bad thing happens at zero. Because when epsilon goes to zero, then you require more and more smaller epsilon balls, and that's where your integrand blows up and makes your integral singular. So there is singularity at zero. And there is also, so this is a version about expectation. There is also a corresponding version about hyperprobability. So not only this holds with expectation, but also this random variable is bounded by the right-hand side with very high probability. And the version of this statement is that if you divide the left-hand side by the right-hand side, the random variable will be subgaussian. Okay, there may be, when you first look at this theorem, maybe a little mystery of how do you come up with the square root of logarithm. Well, logarithm of the covering number is called metric entropy. What is the meaning of the square root of logarithm? Well, there is nothing mysterious about it. It's just square root of logarithm is simply the inverse of e to the u square, which is a Gaussian table. You started with the Gaussian or sub-Gaussian process for which you had the tail of sorts, e to the minus u square. Then you invert that and get square root of logarithm. And for this reason, if you go through the proof of this, and there is reference to the proof in the notes that I gave you. If you go through the proof, then you will discover that Dudley's inequality holds for almost any other tail. If you start from some exponential process, there will be, for example, so sub-exponential is e to the u instead of e to the u squared. So you will have just log of n without square root. If you start with some polynomial tail, it will be corresponding. Power there. So it's a very general statement. And we'll try and apply it for our situation now. So recall what we have is a random process indexed by the sphere. It's an explicit process. We can write it up like this. It's every random variable is like that. And we apply Dudley's inequality. We try to apply Dudley's inequality. To apply Dudley's inequality, we'll need to check that the process has controlled speed. The speed is the increments, so we look at the increments, divide by the time. Again, the time is the distance between the two points. Our points are not points on the sphere, so the distance will be the Euclidean distance or geodesic distance, doesn't really matter. Here I use the Euclidean distance. So this is time, and this is the increments. We have to check that this is sub-Gaussian. So as before, we just write, so to check these increments, we write our the norm of AX as a sum of independent random variables, sub-exponential, use central limit theorem, Einstein inequality. It's all very simple now because for now we just fix X and Y, right? We do not have a big random process. We ignore everything else. Just fix X and Y. This is our one random variable. We check what happens for this random variable. Write it as a sum of independent random variables, apply Bernstein's inequality, and arrive at some conclusion. If you do the proper algebra, you will have conclusion that your tail is a combination of sub-exponential and sub-Gaussian. Every time it picks a word. If u is smaller than 1, it picks u squared. If u is bigger than 1, it picks u. So it's the worst case for the two. So it's a combination of sub-Gaussian and sub-exponential tail. But Dudley's inequality is pretty general, can handle this tail as well. You need just to invert this tail when it's called inverse. So this is our speed, it's controllable. We apply Dudley's inequality and invert this tail in order to see what will be the right hand side of Dudley's inequality. The inverse will be log divided by n, square root of log divided by n. This is for sub-Gaussian, this is for sub-exponential, this is for sub-Gaussian. Instead of mean, we have maximum. Instead of multiplying by n, you have divided by n. Instead of exponential, you have logarithm. Just invert everything correctly. And apply Dudley's inequality. So here's the Dudley's inequality tells you is expectation of the supremum of our process bounded by the integral of the covering number, of the function of the covering numbers, which is our inverse. Here's our inverse. Straightforward. And then we just use the information about this, the covering numbers. What do we know about covering numbers? We know that they're exponential in the dimension. It's 1 over epsilon to the power n. So logarithm of them divided by n is the aspect ratio times logarithm of 1 over epsilon. But the very important point here is that the dependence on epsilon in the covering number is very mild. Epsilon does not enter here, it enters in the base of the exponent. It's 1 over epsilon times n. And as a result, when you invert it, the dependence on epsilon will be even milder. It's logarithm of 1 over epsilon, which is certainly integrable. So there is no singularity, no bad singularity. So this will be bounded by the... So you just integrate logarithm and get some constant out of it. So as a result, you'll have y plus root of y. 1y is for this, square root of y will be for that. And the random process will be bounded as required by the square root of the aspect ratio. That is what we wanted. So then we recall that our process was this, and we get the desired concentration inequality for one vector. For all vectors now. So now we control all of the sphere at once. We have a sub-Gaussian matrix with aspect ratio y. Then the minimum and the maximum singular values are bounded respectively with 1 plus u root of y, 1 minus u root of y. And with high probability means exponential in any solution. Okay? So this way we use the multi-scale epsilon net method and get the result that now matches the asymptotic theory up to this constant c. Okay? Is that good? Okay, now the interesting question here is that what is this constant c? The importance of this problem is that if c is, say, 2 or bigger, then the theorem is only valid, so the lower bound is only useful where y, for the aspect ratios above some constant, for really tall matrices. Because if you have something 1 minus, say, 10 here, the lower bound will be useless with less than 0. So the theorem tells you something good about matrices that are really tall. The aspect ratio has to be big enough. And it is a big problem to understand what would be the lower singular value for matrices that are not tall, that are close to the square matrices. So the conjecture that contains many famous conjectures in non-asymptotic random matrix theory is that if you have a n by n, I will not normalize it, n by n sub-Gaussian random matrix. For example, plus or minus 1 is not even known for that. The smallest singular value will be bigger than or equal to square root of n minus, well, the asymptotic theory will predict you square root of n minus square root of n minus 1, and will be generous enough to put it a constant here with high probability. So the asymptotic theory predicts this without constant c. I'll explain why I subtracted 1. This 1 accounts for the degenerate case where the matrix is, if n equals, if both n's are the same, if you have a square matrix, then square root of n minus square root of n minus 1 would be asymptotic to 1 divided by square root of n. So for the square mesh, it tells you something, and that something is right. So this is von Neumann. This conjecture was sort of stated by von Neumann, although not very explicitly. And this conjecture is general. It contains many conjectures that are known. So this is a nice interpolation from the square matrices to arbitrary matrices. So we wanted to move this constant C from this term up to the whole. Okay. So this is not known. This is now solved. This is Rudolfson and myself, and I will talk about it in small terms. So for the square matrices, it's actually true. We do not know anything about Gaussian,
what's known for a Gaussian dimension?
Yes. So for Gaussian, it's sort of closed. The paper by Edelman, papers by Edelman, around 1989, I guess, proved it for the Gaussian. The important difference that probably want to emphasize this. So for the Gaussian matrices, there are completely different methods to treat all of this theory. And they are based on the fact that for Gaussian matrices, regardless of whether they're squared or rectangular, there's an explicit formula for the singular values, for the eigenvalues of Gaussian matrices. Just write them up for the density for the singular values. Then if you're interested in upper singular value, you just basically integrate out all the smallest ones, and if you're interested for the smallest, you integrate all the bigger ones and get the precise density distribution of the Gaussian matrices. As a nice example, a consequence of the work of Edelman is that if you pick an n by n complex Gaussian matrix, that is, both the real and imaginary parts are distributed identically and independently. If you have a complex Gaussian matrix, then it's small. Largest or smallest? It's largest. Okay, largest. We normalize it. So divided by square root of n. Its largest singular value is distributed identically to the chi-square. So you just know explicit thing here. This result holds independently of the dimension n, and for n equal 1, you can certainly check that. Dimension 1, it will be the square root of the two Gaussians. And that holds for arbitrary. So for non-complex, for real, and for rectangular, all of the corresponding results are known in terms of hypergeometric functions, and you can find them in the work of Edelman or his later survey.
Yeah. Does the slightly work method apply to the square against one?
Yeah, thanks for that. 1 minute. Right, and then but this is all of this is based that there is explicit probabilistic density function of all of the eigenvalues, lambda 1 through lambda n. Explicit formula for that. What the sub-Gaussian matrices are completely different, like plus or minus 1 matrix, because not only there is no probabilistic density function of the eigenvalues, but there is no density at all. There is no density of the entries. Entries are discrete. There is no way you can write any formula for the density. So there is also work that I did not mention in my notes, should have mentioned. Work by Gordon's method that you can read in Davidson and Sharik survey, which is in the notes. This method proves that for the ground shape matrices, the upper singular value is smaller than root of n. Let's not normalize first. Square root of n plus square root of n without any constant. And then if you do normalize, then the constant here will disappear, which will be 1 plus root of y. This is for Gauss matrices. So what is remarkable here is that there is no constant at all. There is just an inequality, not even 1 plus root of 1. So everything is explicit. It matches asymptotic bound, obviously. And the method is not based on the computation, on the explicit formula for this probabilistic density. You do not need to integrate it. It's a separate method, very nice, very soft method. During the students to read this, it's just one page.